Okay. Today is October the 24th, 2007, and I am here with Alvin Armstrong at his residence in Lexington, Kentucky, and my name is Mary Reed. Mr. Armstrong is going to tell us about his military experience in World War II. So, Mr. Armstrong, what year did you join?
I was drafted in...
You were drafted. Okay.
In April of... 1941.
Now, was that into the Army?
Army.
Okay. All right. Can you tell us then about your experience?
Well, the fellow in charge of the draft board, I met him on the street on Saturday, and he said, "Alvin, you're going to the Army Tuesday." I said, "Wait just a minute. I'm not mad at nobody. I don't believe in fighting. I don't go to the Army." He said, "Well, you got two choices, go to the Army or go to jail."
Wow.
I said, "I'll go to the Army."
Yes.
So they said I just had to go for 1 year, and I spent 4 years, 5 months, and 22 days in the military.
And you still remember exactly how many days here?
Yes. Yeah. And so I was inducted in Louisville, the post office, and I was shipped to Cincinnati and got all of my military equipment, shipped back to Fort Knox for my basic training, and I got through my basic training. They pulled me out of the group and made me a sergeant and shipped the rest of them on out to another camp. So I helped train two different outfits after I got my training. I was called a drill sergeant, and the last ones we trained were they asked us, sergeants, to go with the guys we trained, and we went to several different camps, pulled two maneuvers in Louisiana, one in the summer and one in the winter, and we shipped from there to San Diego, California. Spent several weeks there, amphibious training, and we left Camp Cook. I left San Diego and went to Camp Cook. We was home guard there for several months, and they finally said, "We got to ship you overseas." So we left Seattle, Washington, and went to the Hawaiian Islands. And when we went there, we were really scheduled to go to the Philippines operation, but we didn't get in the Hawaiian Islands soon enough, so they pulled all the home guard out of the Hawaiian Islands and sent them in our place. And so we had to be home guard for several months. And finally, they was making up plans for the operation of Okinawa. And they said, "We need to have tank flamethrowers to go to Okinawa due to the caves and the ledges, coral rock. Nothing else would take the place of flamethrowers." So we was made a flamethrower outfit. Before, we were a 75-millimeter tank outfit. So we spent several months cutting all the ammunition racks out, moving everything that was not needed in the flamethrower, and mounted all of our flamethrower equipment into the 75-millimeter tanks. But with very little training, loaded up and set sail, and we didn't know where to. And Tokyo Rose come on every day at 12 o'clock, and she told that the 713th Flamethrower Battalion was headed for Okinawa. And we did not know it until we heard her say it. And after 4 or 5 days, they come over the loudspeakers that she was exactly right, that we was going to Okinawa. So I spent a month or two on the ships making up the convoy. We stopped at a lot of different islands all up through the Pacific. And we spent a whole week in the Philippines waiting for the rest of the troops to catch up with us. So we set sail for Okinawa and pulled in there at dark, and all night long they pounded the beaches with the big naval guns, and we knew that we were headed for a big fight. So Easter morning at daylight, we started going ashore for the invasion. So I thought I'd be smart and get in the back of the line and watch everything and find out what was going on before I got involved. And lo and behold, they called me from the back up to the front to fire the first mission of the 713 flamethrowers.
They must have thought a lot of you.
They knew that I was an agricultural type guy and knew the terrains and everything and was aware of what's laying ahead of us. So about two lengths of a football field, we run into opposition and we knew the war was on. So we spent several weeks and months making our way through Okinawa. But the sad part of it was that Okinawa was the enemy's artillery range. They had every inch of the island mapped out, and if they knew where you was at, you was in big trouble. And the bad part of our situation was when we'd fire a mission, there'd be a big billow of smoke roll into the air, and they knew exactly where we was at, and so here would come the artillery. So we had to fire a mission and turn around and scat out of there. And so leave the poor infantry on the ground to hold it. So this went on for quite a length of time. And about halfway through the operation, a big typhoon hit Okinawa. And they have 175 mile an hour wind. And it blew all of our medical records clear away. Never could find them. And after the typhoon had passed over, we went back to fighting again. And so what would happen if we would take a hill? When you're fighting a defensive war is different from an offensive war. They were dug in and hid, and we couldn't find them. And so we had to get out in the open to get them to start shooting at us before we could find them. And so my job was, as a tank commander, is make all the decisions and corrections and so forth right in the middle of the operation. So we would go and fire our missions, and the medics would pick up the dead and wounded, and they'd lay them on the back of my tank, and I would back up as far as I could, get away from the enemy before I turned around, and they still would shoot at them while I was on the back of the tank. So it gives you a bad feeling when you go over the hills into the front lines and see all the dead laying on each side of the road and wonder if you're going to be there with them next morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so this went on for quite a while. So long toward the last, they were using the flamethrowers every day from daylight till dark because they're so effective. So finally we pushed them back to the ocean, and they didn't have any place else to go, and a lot of them started giving up and coming over to our side. But it's a sad situation to be in. I remember my algebra teacher said one time that war is the most horrible thing could ever come to the face of the earth, and I had to experience it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's things that happen to you there that you never get away from, sticks with you for the rest of your life. I said when I left there that I was going to forget all that that I'd seen and did, but it followed me home, and it's just a thing that you can't get it out of your sights. I've seen people go completely bananas, just nutty as a fruitcake. And You try to help them and do what you can, but you have to watch them and hold on to them, or they get up and walk right into the front line and get killed. But it's a thing that where the guys spend days and nights and eating together, you learn to bond. There's a bond there that you don't get anywhere else, because they're guarding your back while you're guarding their back. So that's the reason that since we come home and we have our reunions every year, that we're just excited and appreciate each other so much. Of course, we had to fight World War II over every time we get together.
Yeah.
As old timers. But I was president of the 713 Flamethrower Battalion for about 8 or 10 years. So this past year, I passed it on to somebody else. So I felt like I'd had it long enough. I was also secretary and financial officer. So I had double duty. But I enjoyed it. All my life I've always said, if I'm in the service of my fellow man, I'm in the service of our God. And I believe that. But as you get older, you watch a lot of the fellas bear the testimony of the military and the wars and so forth. And it's so easy to start getting the teardrops to fall again.
How many years were you in the service?
Pardon?
How many years were you in the service?
4 years, 5 months, and 22 days.
So you were in until the end of the war?
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't mention that after the war was over, the two big bombs were dropped. We were getting prepared to invade Tokyo, and after they dropped the bombs, they said the war was over. So we parked our tanks and grabbed up our personal gear and headed for South Korea. I was in charge of a big train station. A little town called Yeongdongpo. It was the main rail center between the north and south. And I was in charge of that, clear up until Thanksgiving and loaded on ships and started for home. But that's an experience you wish you didn't have, but since you've had it, you do the best you can with it.
Mm-hmm. Your flamethrowers, can you describe what they were like?
The flamethrowers were patented by an individual. What we would do is split our 75mm guns wide open, mount all of the flamethrower equipment in there. It had to have valves and out at the end of the the barrel, you have a great big spark plug with a wide gap in it. And in the bottom of the tanks, you got four big barrels like that holds about 100 and 150 gallons of napalm. Now, napalm was made out of 100-octane gasoline, and it's a red powder like yellow. You put it in the barrel and agitate it for a while, and it's just like red jello. And when you fire it, we had to have 3 CO2 bottles for pressure to blow the napalm out. And we could get 150, 200 feet with a flamethrower.
So this was in a tank. This wasn't a tank on your back or?
No, it was not a portable tank. It was an M4. A medium-sized tank.
Okay.
And we had to rearrange all of the equipment inside to fit the flamethrower equipment. And so sometimes you'd have faulty valves or something that you had to come back and get it repaired. But do they use the big high-pressure hose to carry the fuel from the tanks out into the end of the gun? And the napalm would go, it traveled just like a football. You had to arch it high and it'd go over and hit what you're after. See, the enemy had dug back in the mountain and had piled big high mounds of dirt out in front of the caves. And when they'd go into the cave, they'd go around that mound of dirt and on in the caves. And what we'd do is back up to where our plane would go over the top of the mound of dirt and right on in the caves then. And their theory, after we'd pushed them as far back as they could, their theory was to work and weave their way through the front lines and destroy American supplies and so forth, and then most of them never did get through the lines. But it was just a makeshift type thing, and it turned out so successful. And after the war was over, we got a presidential citation for our performance on Okinawa. And since we were holding our meetings and everything in Fort Knox, we decided to have a monumental marker put in with a plaque on it of the 713 Flamethrowers. We was held so highly then. And I spent almost a year having this plaque put in, and then we had a dedication, of course. But every year, just a few days before Easter, which was D-Day for us, I would go to Fort Knox and put a big wreath on the monumental marker. So I've done that for 25, 30 years.
Wow. How many members were there?
Starting out, it was 724 officers and men, 54 tanks.
Wow.
And now I've got less than 100 men on my mailing list have died. We're losing all 5, 6, 8, 10 every year. See, they're all up in their mid-80s and upper-80s. We got some at almost 90 years old.
Well, they've lived a long life.
I'll be 89 my next birthday. So I'm up in that bracket, too.
Yeah.
So I have to keep all my ducks in order.
So did the flamethrowers go in and kind of clear the way for the ground troops?
What would happen there when the infantry, see, we worked as a team. You had the infantry and the artillery and the 75 millimeters and the flamethrowers. We all worked as a team. And when the infantry run in stiff positions they couldn't take, they'd back up a little bit and let the flamethrowers come in and show us where the targets were, and we'd go after them.
Okay.
And we never went hardly on our own to do anything by ourselves. We had to have 275-millimeter tanks, one on each side of us for protection, because our range was so low, short, that they could be just out of our reach and shoot us to death. And then the 75 millimeters would take over from there. At one particular time, I had a picture of the Kentucky, the silhouette and everything, fastened on the top of my antenna. It said on there, "United we stand, divided we fall." And I went into the edge of the mountains and burned out caves and pillboxes and so forth. And there was an enemy artillery gun sitting out in the valley. He started firing direct fire at me, and he was getting closer with every round he fired. And when I got back, I seen where they'd shot my antenna off. blew my air filters all off of the tank, and we were lucky to get back alive. And they were really pounding us good. And the thing that hurt my feelings, it knocked my Kentucky flag down. I didn't like that very good. But
a true blue sun.
Yeah, it hurt my feelings when it did that.
Okay. Were you married at the time you were drafted?
No, I was not married. No. Okay. I didn't marry until I was in 52. I got married.
Okay.
And my wife and I have a basketball team and two cheerleaders.
How many children does that add up to?
37. Grandchildren.
Good grief. Good grief.
That's some of them. The one on the left there is, he went to Ukraine and adopted two kids. He had six of his own and he went and adopted two more, a boy and a girl.
My goodness.
And the boy is as smart as a tack. He's a very sharp boy. He's the one right behind his mother.
Okay.
First one down.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the girls are giving him a hard time all the time, running after him and talking to him and everything. But then I have one son that has two Chinese children, about 3, 4 years old. One of them's down there at the bottom on the second one, on the left.
Well, you're a real international family, sounds like.
Well, I've always tried to be a role model all my life, even in the military and when I come home. And my dad always told me, sit out and try to be good for something and no need of being good for nothing. So I took his word as well.
Now, did you have brothers that served in the war with you, or?
Four boys in my family, and all of us was in the service.
At the same time?
Two of us was in, my brother was in Europe under Patton, and I was in the Pacific. And the other two brothers was drafted later on after we got home.
Oh, after peace, you were
peacetime.
In peacetime.
Just two of us was in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And General Buckner from Carrollton, Kentucky, was in charge of the operation of Okinawa. And 5 minutes before he was dead, I could put my arm on his shoulder. I was that close to him.
Hmm.
And 5 minutes later, come over the radio, and General Buckner just got killed by an artillery shell. And I couldn't believe it. He had much more left in my tank until he got hit.
Hmm.
But that's war for you. You don't know when you're in somebody else's sights.
Right.
I've seen the time that you're lucky to be where you're at the right time. I was pulling into my bivouac area. Now, the way we worked it there then, was we pull a tank over a level piece of ground and then move it out and dig about a 2-foot hole big enough for four men to get in. And then we'd pull the tank back over the hole and pull our blankets underneath and just lay in that cold ground and sleep. And 5 minutes before I pulled into my bivouac area, there was an artillery shell landed right in the hole where we had dug. It blew our bedding, our mess kits, all of our personal gear, just blew it away. And, boy, this is my lucky day.
Yes.
It had been just 2 or 3 minutes later, we would have got it.
Uh-huh.
But I've seen the time that, artillery was so bad that there's two tanks. Pull the tanks right up against each other and dug a big hole behind the tank away from the enemy line. And the nine of them was in this hole sleeping. and the artillery shell went in the ground under the tank, went 2 foot under and come out in the hole and exploded while all those guys were sleeping. Nobody would go up there and identify those bodies, but they all bounced on me to go up there and identify those guys. Man, I tell you, that was tough.
Because I can imagine that would be a nightmare that keeps returning.
That's the one of the bad ones for me.
Mm-hmm.
And my mail carrier is such a nice guy, he comes up and puts my mail in the bag behind the door.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have a little bit of a hill to get down to your mail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have trouble getting down that hill and back.
Well, especially when it's wet like today.
When I moved here, I wasn't having any trouble getting up and down the hill. I got 2 letters going out. I hope he gets them.
I'm sure he will.
Yeah.
I'll get this for you. Oops, looks like I brought the leaf.
Don't worry about them leaves. They're coming and going. I had a lot of mailmen, but he's the nicest one I've ever seen.
Looks like mostly junk. It's so typical.
Yeah.
There you go. You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Well.
Anything else you need to know?
Well,
I've got all day. I don't have anything else to do.
You don't have anything else to do. Right. Well, I was going to ask you if there's anything else you want to tell me about. You know, your experiences are that time.
A lot of people say they wasn't scared when they're going to the front lines, but they are.
You've got to be.
They put up a shield and try to impress their mind that they're not scared. But everybody's scared to death. So they can't tell me any different. I've been there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sad to see those guys go completely nuts. I've had guys run, grab me around the neck, and hold on, crying. Just never seen them before in my life.
Do you think the wars today are any different on the soldiers than they?
Push-button wars now.
Push-button?
Yeah. Fire and artillery, rockets, planes.
But yet so many of them have trouble adjusting when they come back.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's different today than it was during World War II?
I think they've got a treatment that helps them get over that and go through certain training and so on, treatment and so forth, kind of gets them pulled out of it, but you never get it completely cleared up. My wife and I went to New York one time. We took a tour all through New York. We seen guys laying right beside the gutters on the street, just alcoholics and dope addicts. And the guide that told us that just about every one of them are guys that come back from the war and couldn't get over it. And trying to drown their sorrow and their experiences with alcohol and dope.
Well, my husband served during the Vietnam War, and I know so many people that I would just say are totally nuts from it. But yet, I don't remember people from the World War II era, which my father served in, as being nuts. They seemed to function well in the world, unless it was hidden from me and not talked about or...
Sometimes they had to put them in a room and lock a door so they couldn't walk away and stuff like that. I have no knowledge of what they're doing. I've gone in the Veterans Administration several times to visit people that's in there. And it's really scary and touching going there and see those guys like that. Some of them, the war comes back to them and they want to start fighting a guy next to them or... bang their head against the wall and everything. I come back with the complex. I couldn't leave it. I said I wasn't going to let any of that follow me home, but it did. For months and months, I could be laying in the bed, and if the wind blew the door to and made a popping noise, I'd jump out of that bed and start running around the bed looking for a foxhole to get in. And that's a bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
I got over a lot of it, but I still hear some loud popping noise. I jump up in bed and look all around.
Hmm. Was there any therapy or offered to you all when you came back?
I tell you the way I felt. I said, whatever bugging me, I will get over it eventually. And I don't want to go through no strenuous treatment and medication and everything. They experimented on some guys, you know, giving certain drugs that ruined their mind. In the war, or in the army, rather, they call it losing it when the guy goes nuts.
Okay.
Losing it.
Okay.
But I'm lucky to be as well as I am. See, guys so much younger than me passing away. I feel like I'm really lucky to be as well as I am. Now, my driver got killed halfway through the operation. The last thing I told him before he went into the front lines, I said, don't get out of your tank for anything unless it's on fire or you got hit and can't move. I said, other than that, stay in that tank. Well, he hadn't been gone 20 minutes or a half an hour. Come over the radio, D.L.R. DeWitt got killed. Oh, boy. Sniper got him right through here, cut everything completely into her.
Mm-hmm.
And he was standing and talking to a lieutenant. A lieutenant called him on the radio and told him, come over and show him the target and everything you need to fire. And just as soon as he stepped up on that tank, the lieutenant got it right through here, and he got it right through here.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a young fellow, about 22 years old, and had a wife and a little girl. And I had to go through all of his equipment and everything, pick out his personal stuff, put it in a container, and mark it so they'd ship it back to his wife. Boy, that was rough.
Now, how old were you at this time?
I was drafted. I turned 21 in May and went to the Army in April.
Okay.
Boy, they were sitting waiting for me as soon as I told you when they got me. I didn't have a chance to go nowhere. But on my 24th birthday, I was on Okinawa then. Mother's Day was a big day for me. Chocolate Drop Hill was one of the toughest hills out of all of Okinawa. They were so well fortified, and it was close to the capital of Okinawa, and they tried to do everything to protect it. But I was right in the middle of that. I seen 12, 15 tanks just blow to all pieces, and I was right up around them, burning out pillboxes. And their theory was that we ought to give about 3 or 4 squirts with a flamethrower, and they told their men to wait till we made those 3 or 4 spurts and then go after us with a satchel charge. It's a square box, about that big a square, full of gunpowder. And there was a tube of nitroglycerin right in the top. They'd run dive out of the tanks and hit that nitroglycerin and it go off and blow the tank all to pieces.
Hmm.
A lot of them got hit that way. But we got smart after we read some of their hot poop sheets, they called it. What they would put out, you know, on their side.
Uh-huh.
We'd get those and their interpreter would tell us what they said. Sit down and wait till they get through firing and then you go get them. And we'd fire 2, 3, 4 rounds and sit there and wait. Here he'd come. We'd hit him with that flamethrower and he'd cartwheel right through the air. That nitroglycerin would go off. He would go with it. But they have added living wasn't important. Just dying for the country is important to them.
Hmm.
That's the way they look at it. I told everybody I'd rather be a living coward than a dead hero. To smell the flowers then.
Now, what you referred to a pill box. What is a pill box?
A pill box is where they dig in the ground like two or three feet, and they put big logs this big around. It's just like they're building a log house.
Okay.
And lay them on the end of each other. And then they'd pile dirt up against that. And they'd have a slot about like that where they'd stick the barrel of gun through.
Okay.
And then they could move it around. And
okay.
See, they had every inch of that island measured off. And if they knew where you was at, you was in trouble. So that's what we had to deal with all the time.
Now, did they put roofs over these barricades or those pill boxes?
Some would lay logs over the top, you know, just like a log house.
Okay.
And the logs were big enough that it was hard for the shells to penetrate through them. But they had a gun that was dangerous, called it a 47 millimeter. And they had their bullets so made they could fire on an angle instead of ricocheting off like our gun would do. That bullet would turn like that. The lead on the end of the bullet would stick and hold the shell, and it would turn and go right through that tank.
Huh.
The front of those tanks was 2.5 inches steel, and the back part of it was 2 inches steel. And sometimes those shells would go inside the turret, and they'd go round and around in the turret, wiping everything out as it went. We had one Mexican fellow from Chicago. He was a clown. I never didn't know what his name was. We call him Pedro Lopez, Pasquale. Anything we call him, yeah, I'm okay. He was a tank driver, and his tank got hit. A shell went right through the front of the turret and hit the two big batteries. The two batteries about that big. And the two of them, and the shell went right through there and blew those batteries up. And that's about that close to his head. He got battery acid in his eyes. Yep. And the tank commander said, well, get out and run for it, boys. This thing's going to burn up. And they jumped out, and he was running, but he didn't know which way he'd going, but he couldn't see it.
Uh-huh.
And we'd ask him, Chico, how'd you know you was going in the right direction? He said, every once in a while somebody passed me, just fly. Just fly. But I knew I was going the right direction. But they did wash his eyes out and kept patches over him for a while. And he got his eyesight back. But he's lucky. That battery acid is a boy's potent stuff.
Yeah, it'd be awful.
Yeah, just like your car batteries.
Mm-hmm. Did you write this information here?
I don't have my glasses with me. Somebody got a little of the history of how the organization was organized. And
now, that may have been your son-in-law, Kevin Massey. Uh-huh.
Now, my son, the one on the left there, down on the left-hand corner, he put a lot of stuff in the computer, and I never did know exactly what he put in there.
Okay.
I think he got a hold of some of the history of the 713.
Now this is your son-in-law Kevin Massey sent this.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Now if you would like that, you may have it.
I keep looking, Dad.
I can download another copy myself. But I don't know. That just came along with the information with your name and number, and So it could just be that it's already in the, you know, on the computer or the internet somehow, and he just forwarded that information. But that is your division there, so
yeah.
Doesn't mention any names, but it kind of talks about the history of what the flamethrowers were and where they served. But why don't you just keep that copy?
Well, if you're gonna
give them, I appreciate
it. Yeah, sure. I'm sure that my son is. He had another guy out in Illinois, I believe it is, Mr. Fox. They talked back and forth on the computer all the time. And they worked up deals and putting stuff in the computer system. And I sent out a newsletter every year telling everybody where the reunion will be and what the cost will be in the hotel and dinners.
Uh-huh.
Always had a banquet at the end of our reunion. And so I'm sure that's where some of this comes from.
Okay.
Would you be interested in seeing a little of the operation of Okinawa?
I would. Yes, I would.
I don't know how your time runs.
Well, I'm in Lexington for the day, so it's all right.
You're home.
But at this point, I think what I'll do is just turn the recorder off, and
okay.
And I'll watch. Yeah.
Okay. There's a strength of Okinawa's mountains, especially in the southern part of the island. Ushijima intended to permit the Americans to come ashore without opposition. This would allow time to prepare for the coordination of a land and sea strike. March 4th, 1945, at 0900 hours, the 713th left Pearl Harbor for Okinawa. Operation Okinawa was already underway by the time the 713th arrived at Shima on April 7th, 1945.
You're going to put this one tank flamethrower in there, and you wanted all this history and everything to go with
it. The Japanese had dug in deep to protect themselves from the bombardment of American military fire. On April 19th, 1945, the Japanese experienced the first terrifying attack of flame-throwing M4s. From that day on, a general cry went up and down the front lines. Hey, Zippo, come on! The Japanese soldier, confident he was safe from even the power of the 75mm gun, was surprised when a safe place became a flame trap.
Yeah.
Well, give us a light where we were
at. Uh-huh.
Divisions worked and lived together as one unit. They successfully completed numerous missions that were necessary to bring the Okinawan campaign to a victorious end.
Wait to see the 713 flamethrower tents come up. And when they see them, they was happy. And when what would happen, they had radios on the back of the tank. And the infantry would follow the tank and tell the tank where to go. And tell the tank where to shoot the flame. And this was how close they were working together. So that the tank protected the infantry, and yet the tank shot the flame out to kill the enemy. That there was a good deal of Japanese that the flamethrowers killed, that the infantry didn't have to, and the infantry didn't have to worry about them killing them.
Thank you.
going to be this, they're going to be that. And usually it was a case that they wanted to do something with the Japs because there was no secret about what the Japs was doing. They read to all the troops and the people and like that, that they was conquering over there in the Pacific area, that they just wanted to get in there and eliminate the Japs the best way they could. And that this was it, because they came up with the bit as to why they were going to do this, change it over into the flamethrowers, and that was because of the situation came back that Okinawa was all full of tunnels and the Japs was all dug in and like that, and it would be impossible to shoot and get at them. So they had to burn them out, and this was the best way to get at it. So this is what went about, and it didn't seem to create any problems or bad feelings against any of the personnel.
Flamethrowers like start forest fires that burned, or was it? Okay.
Those little straw shacks and stuff.
Right.
They live in. They last long with flame.
Okay.
And you were split up throughout the whole organization. Some went with A company, some went with B company, some went with C company, and then we were to direct the firing of the tanks. If the infantry couldn't get close enough to them that they could use their phone, we were in the back, a little further back, and we had they called 5010 radios on our backs. And then we could stay in touch with all the tanks. Now, when we called them, we told them exactly where the enemy was, because we always were on a high area where we could overlook the whole situation. And we can also see where all the fire was coming in from, where the firepower was. And that's how we used to direct them. And many times, the fire was so heavy that we had to jump on the tank and get the heck out of there with them, because it was getting too heavy. The guns outshot us, so sometimes we had to withdraw a little bit, and then we called different tanks in, which the different tanks fired at a distance where we saw the flames. And the cannon fires, there is a slight flame. And we used to observe that, and if you used to see any of those light flames, right away, we take the coordinates on the map, we call it in, and they fire at that. And within two or three rounds, they most likely, they knocked them out. But that's how we...
Yeah, his name is Edith.
back, we didn't get too far with them. But we took some women and children. We took them back. But if he was a soldier, he didn't have much of a chance.
Battalion received from generals on down only the highest praise for a consistently outstanding record of performance. The unit received a presidential unit citation as well as citations for individual missions. Here are some excerpts from several of those citations. The infantry's Lieutenant Colonel Edward Stair commended the 713th for its invaluable assistance during each attack phase and the final drive against the enemy lines near Koki. The flamethrower tanks were literally the straw that broke the camel's back. Immediately after the flamethrower tanks had gone into action, the infantry was able to rapidly advance. He continued to praise the men of the 713th for the courageous manner in which they performed, and hoped that in future operations, the 713th would be in support of his battalion. Colonel Stephen S. Hamilton of the 307th Infantry expressed his appreciation of the 713th for their excellent support rendered in the reduction of the Japanese strong point in the outer Shuri defense system. He continues to say that all personnel of the 713th gave the closest cooperation and aid to further the advance of the combat team and assisted in the capture of enemy positions. Another commendation came from the headquarters of the 763rd Tank Battalion. It stated that all members of the 713th should be commended for their fine performance during the period from April 8th to April 30th, 1945. Each man and officer acted in a manner that brought the highest credit to the unit. All company commanders expressed their satisfaction at the ease and efficiency of the 713th's ability to become an integral part of the 763rd Battalion. Cooperation was at all times superior, and they were always ready and willing to undertake any assigned mission, no matter how difficult the terrain or complicated the mission. Even Major General J. L. Bradley expressed his appreciation of the excellent spirit and accomplishments of the 713. John M. Finn, commanding officer of the 32nd Infantry, went into great detail describing his appreciation. He stated that the flamethrower tanks were an innovation to his regiment. They were effective against the Japanese position on Skyline Ridge and showed their true worth at Coral Caves on Hill 95. Japanese were in position over the whole escarpment, and the rugged caves and pinnacles offered natural defensive positions and cover. In many places, it was almost impossible to blast out the defenders with artillery and mortar fire. He continues to say that it became apparent that the positions could only be taken at a great loss of life and some means of routing out the enemy. The flamethrower tanks were brought forward. Flames lit into the caves and crevices and burned many Japanese at their positions. The most remarkable effect was the terror instilled in the heart of the enemy. Colonel Finn then continues to praise the men who manned the tanks. It was through their courage and devotion to duty that the tanks were moved into position where the flame could take effect. Where tanks could not reach the enemy positions with direct flame, men did not hesitate to man the hoses and scale the coral cliffs to burn out the enemy. 2 members of the 713 were awarded the Silver Star Medal for their performances of duty, which typified the dedication of all members of the 713. The feelings of the infantry frontline soldiers were illustrated by the remark, "These guys are okay. They're willing to fight and hell." Even Major General A.V. Arnold was moved by the outstanding performance of the 713th. He sent a personal commendation to the battalion, saying it gave him great pleasure in commending all officers and men of the 713th for their outstanding performance of duty against a bitterly resisting enemy. Their contribution was very important to the winning of such battles as the Yodik Escarpment, Hill 95, Hill 115, Hill 89, Yonabaru, the Shuri Line, and other strategic points during Operation Iceberg. In 70 days of continuous operations in Okinawa, 41 tanks were put out of commission by enemy actions. All but 2 were repaired and returned to service. 4,788 Japanese were killed and 49 captured. The world's only flame-throwing tank battalion had 724 officers and men. 8 men were killed in action and 210 wounded, missing, and injured in combat. They had a headquarters and a service company, A, B, C companies, and a medic detachment.
Now, in the northern part of Okinawa was more flat terrain. And the Japanese didn't have the opportunity to dig in the northern part like they did the southern part. So this was basically the biggest obstacle that the United States Army had to become to get over. That the Marines, they went to the north and they had relatively smoother operation going north. And the army went south, that's where they met all the opposition where the Japs all dug in. They were dug into the mountains, and when the army would shell them, well, then they'd go back into the caves, but as soon as they stopped shelling them, they would come out and they would start shooting at troops again.
Prior to combat, the 713th maneuvered in the pineapple fields of Hawaii. After the combat missions were completed in Okinawa, the 713th was sent to Korea as an occupational force. They continued to uphold the excellent reputation they had earned in Okinawa.
New Ustad's full force nasal spray, specially made to clear even the toughest mucus out of your nose for 12 hours. Mucinex in, mucus out.
Konnichiwa. So, I've got everything ready for the big Tokyo meeting. I can go ahead and book our plans off your line.
So now you've got the TV on, I guess, right?
Hey, everyone, look, Kim. Daddy